My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. Our next guest is an inspiration to many. After meeting her soldier husband in the late 90s, she threw herself into military life. But after the Iraq War in 2003, she decided to do something for herself. She is now an extreme adventurer. Her next challenge is set to redefine all expectations. We speak about being a mother, managing a household, and polar exploration. Episode 28, Wendy Searle. This is Declassified. Did you always have an active childhood?
I think, probably I'd say yes. I can really clearly remember this family holiday we went on to the Lake District. And there's a picture of me that sums it all up. I'm sat on a rock with my head in my hands, just looking utterly miserable. And I think I was probably soaking wet. And we'd been walking all day. And for whatever reason, it never really captured me when I was younger. It was always something we were kind of made to do. But actually, on reflection, I'm really grateful for that, because I think you come back to it in the end. And we were always going on cycling holidays or walking holidays. And, you know, we had a lovely childhood, but we didn't have a lot of money. And so we didn't go on kind of exciting foreign holidays, but we always went on, it always turned into an adventure of some sort.
Is that from being a little one?
Yeah, from being really small. I can remember going up to the Yorkshire Dales and paddling in the streams up there and kind of rock hopping with my dad. And so we were always very active and outdoorsy, I guess.
But wet and miserable sometimes.
I think I don't know what it is. I think I just didn't appreciate it at the time. And, you know, I had wellies and a rubbish raincoat. And then when you're an adult and you've got decent gear and you've chosen to go, and, you know, when I came back to it later in life, I totally fell in love with it. It was really, so maybe it was always there, you know.
Yeah. Where was you brought up?
In Bedfordshire. I was born in York, but grew up in sort of Bedfordshire, Hertfordshire. So not the most kind of hilly and, you know, beautiful place. But we often went on kind of holidays to the lakes and to Yorkshire and places like that.
Yeah. And what was education like?
I went to it was an all-girls school, but it was a state school. Primary school was very ordinary, and that's the whole thing. I'm kind of, everything about my life pretty much has been quite ordinary. The all-girls school was, the great thing about it was that there was definitely an expectation that you would go on to achieve and succeed in whatever it was you chose to do, because if you wanted to do physics, that wasn't for boys, that was what people did, you know. And I think that was really, that coupled with my I have two brothers, and that coupled with my dad treating us all exactly the same, you know, we were all expected to work hard and do well. And I didn't get any kind of special allowances or different treatment for being a girl. And I think that's kind of really coloured my life now, that, you know, if there's any expectation that you might not do something because of being a woman, that's kind of not even an issue. It's not even something that I've ever considered.
I think because I've got two little girls, and I think it's one thing appreciating that you're a woman or a girl, but it's another thing to be told that you can't do something, or your expectation is to do something. And it's good to hear, actually, schooling is or your school was like that. University then? Anything active in uni?
I went to university in Belfast, and that was quite an adventure for me, because it was a really long way from home. And that was part of the reason, you know, I wanted to kind of do something different. And I joined the OTC with a view to going to Sandhurst. And I was pretty much a terrible OTC cadet. I wasn't particularly into running or anything like that, and struggled with the physical side of it actually quite a lot. You know, I wouldn't say it was particularly active, and I could have made a lot more of it, because Northern Ireland is beautiful. And I could have gone on, you know, out to Fermanagh or Giant's Causeway, and I really never did any of that. It was, you know, much more about student partying.
Yeah, okay. What did you study?
English.
Okay. When did you meet your husband then?
So just after I finished uni. Yeah. So I had plans to go to Sandhurst, and we met just after I finished. And then we had a family, and he went to Sandhurst, I didn't. And actually, I do wonder... sometimes I feel like that's a bit of unfinished business. Like, I've always wondered what it would be like to go and spend time at Sandhurst and do that year. And the idea of the reserves has keeps coming sort of coming round now and again. But I do wonder whether I'd have ended up more or less where I am now, even if I had joined the army. And it's interesting how your kind of life turns out. And that's part of how I've ended up here talking to you now, is about creating opportunities or seizing on opportunities and saying yes to lots of things and just seeing where it takes you.
When did you marry? Was you part of kind of military life straight away then? So you met, when was that, 98,
I think. Yeah. So we got married reasonably young, because it was all supposed to be, you know, you were supposed to be a certain rank before, you know, if you were a young officer, you were supposed to be a certain rank before you got married. And I think he wasn't quite, you know. So we were very young, a young married couple, when we went out to join the regiment in Germany. And really kind of plunged into the military way of life straight away. And I can remember arriving and just feeling completely out of place and really wanting to fit in. And the commanding officer at the time, who was very lovely, but it was all totally intimidating and overwhelming, being only kind of 23, and we had a young child, and we'd sort of already stepped outside the general kind of way of doing things, because we got married at a lower rank and all this sort of thing. And he said, oh, well, when will you be having a cocktail party? And I was just utterly terrified by the whole kind of, you know, regimental life and getting it wrong. And, you know, what if I sort of did something that I shouldn't? And it was quite a bizarre time, and I was desperate to fit in. And everyone was very lovely. We were welcomed into that, the regimental family. But I did feel like I was trying to be something I wasn't some of the time.
Yeah.
And as I got a bit older, and as we actually moved back to the UK, I sort of grew into myself a little bit and just felt like, actually, it's okay to be who you are, and it doesn't matter if you, you know, don't fit that specific mold of what an army wife should, you know, an officer's wife should be like. What does that even mean anymore, you know?
Yeah.
But the regimental family has still looked after us, you know, in through time. So
is he still in?
Yeah.
What's he in?
The Royal Dragoon Guards.
Ah, that explains the cocktail party.
And there was all this regimental silver that, you know, they used to try and take bets on which wives they could persuade to touch the silver for different reasons, and that was all a bad thing because you'd get fined. And you know, it was
protocol,
kind of navigating
yeah.
your way through that protocol, exactly, yeah. Was kind of terrifying when you're so young and trying to make sure that you're doing the right thing for the whole family and making sure that you fit in.
When did you have your first child?
Before we got married. Outrageous. So, she was 3 when we got married.
And that's when you moved to Germany?
Yeah.
When she was 3?
Yeah.
What was it like then? Because you've got all this new... everything's around you is new, and it's different, totally different, you know, different, especially your childhood and your upbringing. You've got this probably a little 3-year-old nutcase running around. And what was it like then?
It was a fantastic experience. We stayed there for 3.5 years, and I made efforts to get involved in the German side of life. So I took her to, you know, ballet lessons and things on the German net, and I really embraced it. I totally embraced it. And we did all the, you know, we went off to the mountains a few times to, you know, experience that. And maybe we could have made more of it. But when you're sort of surrounded by young children, because second and third child followed soon after that, that, you know, we probably could have done more. But I did feel like it was a really happy time that we had all this support. There were lots of other people with young children. And I really clearly remember saying that, you know, the older people in the regiment would say, oh, you know, in the good old days we did this, that and the other, and times have changed. And I remember saying to Jan at the time that, you know, you'll look back on these days and these will be the good old days. And, you know, that's what, 17 years ago now?
Yeah.
And it's so true. I mean, it was a little adventure. It definitely was.
What years were the children born then, the first 3?
Oh, goodness. I can never remember.
We'll edit it if it's wrong.
So 99, 2003, 2004.
2003, your husband went to Iraq. Have you got 1 or 2 children now?
So in 2003, we had 2 children. But if you look at the dates of when the children are born, and then somehow, as if by magic, but he managed to go on tour really soon after each one was born. So by the time he came back and they were, you know, 6 months, whatever, they'd all be kind of in a routine and they'd all be sleeping. Yeah. And, you know, he'd be sort of saying, well, what's been the problem kind of thing? Everything looks fine. So he went off to Iraq when our second child was, do you know what? I can't even remember the whole deployment and being away for training and then the third child arriving was, oh, it's a bit of a blur, to be honest, because there was just so much going on and, you know, it was just a crazy busy time.
Can you remember the being a mum, almost a single mum, and trying to manage it all?
I think I was, you know, that was my experience of the Iraq campaign, was that he just wasn't around and I had, did I have three or did I have two? Anyway, I just remember when he was away and I had three, that I didn't sleep for 6 months. I just, you know, and it was grinding, crushing tiredness. And I can remember feeling like I would like just a small injury, just a little one, enough to put me in hospital for one night, just so that I could sleep. I was absolutely desperate. And I used to dream about going to prison, because in prison you get to sleep 23 hours a day. And everything was about how I'd kind of manage more sleep, because I was getting up in the night and feeding. And then in the day, it was kind of relentless as well. And if you remember in Germany, I don't know what it's like now, but certainly when we were there, Sundays, nothing happened. Nothing was open. There wasn't anything to do. And a lot of the families went back to the UK when they went on deployment to Iraq. And so the just kind of keeping everything going for that amount of time, I can remember it just being, I felt like I'd aged about 10 years in that time. And, you know, your family's not nearby, and people did come out and help. And, you know, I'm really grateful for that. And the regiment did some things, but the amount of people there was tiny. And so you just kind of muddle through. But that was a time that I definitely draw on now, when times are, you know, when I'm having a sort of a time when I need to just keep going and get your head down and carry on, is that, you know, I did all that with no sleep. And so at least if you go to sleep every night, you can kind of get up and you know, face the day with renewed energy. But I can remember just being, you know, just grinding tiredness the whole time. And there was always something to do and someone needed you. And yeah,
you just need sometimes like half an hour or the hour, you know, just to relax. And like you say, I can resonate a little bit with that, with having three myself. And what I'm going to try and jump us to, I suppose, kind of self-care then, and self-compassion, and doing something for yourself. And it was when he came back from Iraq that you decided to start running, I suppose, and doing, like I said, doing something for yourself. What was the kind of drive behind that?
I don't know why I chose a marathon. I think because I'd had this vague idea, and I spoke to somebody who was in the regiment, and he said, oh, you'll never do that. And to me, that was red rag to a bull. I just thought, why can't I do that? And as soon as I got back, we were then quite shortly after back in the UK. And as soon as I was back in the UK, I joined a running club. And it's a bit of a pattern, because I had this goal, and at the time it was a huge goal for me, because I hadn't run more than 5K for I don't know how long, since I was in the OTC probably. And I sat down and worked out how I was going to get to that goal, you know, what I needed to do and what training plan I needed to follow, and, you know, did I need to join a running club, which I did, and set about, you know, the planning and the preparation to do that, and then got the running bug for several years. And I think you kind of fall in and out of love with running from time to time. You know, you have a sort of rash of doing lots of things, and then, you know, maybe have a bit of a break from it and then kind of go back to it. So I was big into running for a long time. And, you know, I just, it felt like a good thing to pursue, because it was something that was for me. But it was also kind of all those health benefits and headspace and all of that, which I really needed after, you know, all the deployments. And
did you get your marathon done?
I did. Yeah. I ran my first marathon was London, and I always think about it at this time of year, because I know there'll be people out there doing the big long runs before before London and other big city marathons, and how important it was to me to succeed at that, and how much also that it was about, I know it sounds really cheesy, but it was about the journey of training. It wasn't just about the marathon day. It was about all the things that I put into it, and the kind of the time between the decision to do it and the arriving at the start line was as important as the marathon itself.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the suffering to get somewhere, those short-term goals, get to 3K, get to 5K, get to 5 miles, get to 10 miles.
It's a funny choice, isn't it, when you think about it? Because actually running, if you're doing it with any effort, no matter how fast you or slow you are, it always hurts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's always suffering involved with anything. And then the crossing the finish line is often the good part, really, or the race is the good part. Is that where you stopped, just one?
No, so then I did a couple of other big city marathons, and then I did the Snowdonia Marathon, which is not up and over, it's sort of round. But it was just stunningly, stunningly beautiful. And it was, you know, there weren't actually that many people. It can't have been that long ago, but, it, you know, numbers have kind of boomed since then. So it wasn't a big event at the time. And it was, you know, being out in the countryside and being in those surroundings to me was so much better. Different, but, you know, for me, that's what I loved, was being out and took up a bit of fell running because we lived in Shropshire at the time. And being out in the hills, and that's when I think it, all of those, that grounding and being out in the, you know, out in the hills and things when I was younger, I just completely fell back in love with it again. You know, running through trail runs as opposed to running on the road or running, God forbid, on a treadmill. You know, and actually being out in nature and running through the forest, and you know, you feel alive.
I think exercise is one thing, but being out in nature is something totally different.
So put those two together and you've got a really powerful tool to, you know, give yourself a bit of, like you were saying, self-care or, you know, a bit of space for yourself in your head as well.
How was you managing with the children? Was you near family then at this point, or was it still just you and your husband?
Not really. No, we weren't. So in Shropshire, we didn't, but we've always kind of always taken it in turns, so we've done it in series a little bit. So he'd been away for a while, and then when he got back, it was kind of my time to do some things. So he really supported me with all the training, and because it is time consuming, and fitting that in around work and everything. So sometimes I go to work and then run home from work, things like that. So we kind of managed it between us, but he was fully supportive of all of that.
You mentioned work. What have you been doing? Have you swapped jobs? Because I know employment for military spouses is I feel really passionate about it, but also I know it can be tricky. Have you always had like meaningful employment wherever you've been?
I've been really fortunate. So I actually started off, and because I then wasn't going to Sandhurst because we had a family, I had to rethink my whole career. And my other sort of thing that I thought about doing was, I always wanted to be Kate Adie growing up and be a war reporter. That was my thing. And so kind of media was something that I was interested in. So I thought, right, how can I actually get to the point where I'm doing something that, like, as you say, is a kind of meaningful career instead of just a stopgap job? So I worked at the, out in Germany, I worked at the nursery, and oh my God, I hated it. It wasn't for me. The kids were great and everything, but it wasn't for me. And my kids were the same age at the time, and it was just, you know, wall-to-wall kids day and night. Yeah. So, but working has always been really important for me, to have, I don't know, that sense of self and identity outside of just being a mum.
Yeah.
And so I started off as a volunteer at Hospital Radio, and then I went to BFBS in Germany. So, Chris Pearson, if you ever listen to this, thank you for giving me my big break, because without you, I would never be sitting where I am today, I don't think. And he just, you know, he took that experience that I had in Hospital Radio, and it was only a dependent job. When I say that, you know, the money was different, but it was still a proper job. And I was a radio news reporter for a while, and then what did I do when I got back? Oh, yeah, so we moved back to the UK. And I wanted to work at a local newspaper, and I was absolutely hell-bent on getting this job at the local newspaper. And they just went, you didn't get a job at the local newspaper. You couldn't just kind of walk in there and say, I'm doing this. And so I was 30, and I went and asked for some work experience. And the editor kind of looked at me and said, well, what do you want that for? And I explained, you know, I want to get a job here. He said, well, there aren't any jobs, you know. So I took my 2 weeks work experience, showed that I could do, and it was page design and layouts of the property pages. So really the lowest of the low in a way. So almost like starting again, but I was willing to do that because I could see that there was an end result that I wanted. And at the end of the 2 weeks, he said, oh, do you want a job? So there obviously was a job there. And he said, I've given you this job because you're tenacious. Mm. And, you know, not necessarily because I had particularly good skills as a, you know, page designer, but and I stayed there for a number of years and learned a huge amount from him. He was a real grumpy old school editor. And he used to sit, we had this big open plan newsroom. It was pretty exciting, you know, even though it was only weekly news, but it was a proper paid for paper. And he'd sit in the corner of this big open plan office. And if you brought him something that was not to standard, he would tear a strip off you in front of everybody. What is this dross that you've brought me? Go away and do it again. And it was actually, you know, quite a difficult environment. But to give him his due, if you did a good job, he'd say, this is amazing. I really love what you've done here. So he was very fair and taught me a huge amount about people management, about how to deal with difficult characters, but also about the world of kind of media as well. And I, you know, again, I'm really grateful to him for that. So John Butterworth and Mike Robinson were my editors there, and they were, you know, old school, but really, and actually Mike Robinson, who was an editor of a sort of sister paper, was quite a character. And I also remember him saying to me, you know, because life happens and, you know, you can have good days and bad days. And he used to say to me, very few things matter much and most things hardly matter at all. And it really stuck with me. And he's got all sorts of pearls of wisdom. Mm. And bless him, he's not with us anymore. But I think you can always learn something. And it's, again, about taking those opportunities and grabbing them with both hands and doing what you can with them.
And with no expectation. You went to that job with no expectation. You just wanted to learn something and improve yourself. And sometimes you've got to do that for free. Sometimes you've got to push it.
I think the thing about working for free is really difficult. And you know, you should never work for exposure. And it's very tricky, actually, because sometimes getting a foot in the door in jobs like that is really difficult. And I'm adamant now that I extend those opportunities to other people trying to get their foot in the door. But paid internships is where it's at, I think, definitely.
Mm. No, it's good advice. Why have I got skydiving written down?
Because this is about taking an opportunity and running with it. And I was going to do a skydive because I eventually started working for ABF, the Soldiers Charity, which is the national charity of the British Army. Really fantastic organisation that helps soldiers, veterans and families in times of need. There you go. I can still trip off their pitch.
What
their
does it stand for, ABF?
The Army Benevolent Fund. So they started in 1944, but they've kind of gradually modernised. So they've kind of stuck these two monikers, these two names together. But they still do exactly what they did in 1944. And they're associated with the regiments and the brigades in a sort of very kind of military style structure. So that the help goes direct to kind of welfare funds and things. And they're an amazing charity. And I was working for them and signed up to do a skydive. And was honestly, I so scared. So scared I put it off for a whole year. And then I went to do this. A friend was doing their accelerated freefall course. They were learning to be a skydiver. And I hadn't actually done the charity dive at that point, but they had what's called walk-up tandems. So you could just go up and do a tandem skydive. And I thought, if I don't do it now, I will not be able to get through the fear. I had to do it without any kind of build-up, I suppose. And then the second I left the plane, I thought, oh my God, why have I waited all this time? This is what I want to do for the rest of my life. And it's just such a focused, sensory, joyful, unbelievably exciting experience that is on the other side of fear. So the ride up to altitude was terrifying. And then you get out the plane and it just is an unbelievable freedom. And if anybody has never tried it who's listening, you know, you have to do it, because until you've done it. And when I've seen people do tandem jumps in since then, nobody ever lands and goes, it was all right. They either go, oh my God, that was amazing. Or, you know, they were terrified. But 9 times out of 10, it's amazing.
Yeah.
And after that, I decided I was going to set about becoming a licensed skydiver. And so when I did that, I think it probably took me about 50 jumps. And it takes you about 18 jumps to get qualified. But it took me about 50 jumps to not be utterly terrified. So 50. So I don't know what kept me coming back. It was like a determination to succeed. It was because when you do get out the plane, it's amazing. And, you know, wanting to prove myself that to myself that, you know, you can achieve anything. And I think what that really taught me, and it's been quite a kind of, I don't know, the thing that it's taught me is that you can be scared and carry on doing something. Mm. That shouldn't be a reason not to do it. And it was, oh my God, so worth it. You if you haven't done it, you should.
I've never done it. How many have you done?
180 something. Oh, you know, I'm a nothing and a nobody in skydiving terms.
Oh, is that not many?
Not at all. I'm still on my journey, but I've actually stopped jumping this year because I'm worried about getting injured and that will affect my training. So
is it a risk getting injured?
I broke my wrist doing it. But that was probably more user error. But you know, you can sprained ankles and that kind of thing are reasonably common.
I remember a good mate of mine was in Paderborn and the skydiving facility at Sennlager. He did a week's course, and it always put me off because he smashed all his shin. It was his fault, but it always put me off. But amazing. What, how many? 180
something. And usually, you know, this is how I know that I haven't jumped for a while, because usually you know to the number. Because when you get to 200, you get a sort of new license, if you like.
Come on, get them in. There's only 20 to go.
Yeah, I'll come back to it. You know, when I finish my expedition.
Yeah, let's go to expedition. Why did you? What was the process then of marathon, kind of skydive, into expeditions? These kind of long haul expeditions.
It was probably more like in other similar situations in my life that I came to this idea of wanting to do an expedition to the South Pole, and then I set about what the things I needed to do to make that happen. So when I was working for ABF, the Soldiers Charity, a team of soldiers came to the charity and said, "We're going to ski across Antarctica and we're going to raise some money for you." And I thought, that's great. You know, we have lots of people come and say they're going to do a marathon or, you know, sit in a bath of beans or whatever it is they're going to do to raise money. But they needed a bit of... So my job was to promote some of these things that people were doing. And as I was speaking to them, it transpired that it was something a bit more extraordinary than your average Three Peaks or, you know, whatever that is. And I started just doing a little bit of reading around the subject, because actually, although I'd heard of Scott and Shackleton and Amundsen, it was not something that, you know, I've always had this long held dream ever since I was a child to go and do this. It's something that I've come to sort of in more recent years. But I started reading all this polar history and I got absolutely hooked on this idea of the idea of Antarctica, the idea of this, you know, what the human body can go through, what the human psyche can cope with, what those original kind of golden age of polar explorers went through was monumental. You know, they didn't actually have a map for where they were going. They didn't know what they'd find over the next horizon. And then I started joining the team to cover some of their training. And they went off to various kind of places in the UK, and they sat in this lecture by Professor Chris Imray, who's a specialist in cold weather injuries. And he put all these slides up on the board and said, you know, these are the cold weather injuries. And it was sort of people with hands and black fingers and bits falling off them and stuff. And I had a colleague with me there at the time. My colleague leant over and he said, "Oh my God, this looks absolutely horrendous." And I thought, "Oh my God, this looks absolutely amazing. Why would anyone not want to have a go at this?" And I didn't really think that it was more of a pipe dream, to be fair, at the time. And then I was lucky enough to go to South America to see the team off and help them with their prep and see all that kind of build up. And I was absolutely, that was it. You know, I thought, you know, I just wonder if it's possible for someone who is almost at a standing start in terms of you know, big expeditions and polar travel. And, you know, I'd never done anything like that before. I'd been on an OTC skiing trip once in my life and it was a catastrophe. So, you know, I wasn't a skier. I hadn't been on sort of long range adventures, but I just wondered. And then by the time I got back to the UK, I was thinking, right, how am I going to, you know, find a way to go to this extraordinary place? And that's when the expedition idea sort of started to be formulated.
Mm. And what would have you, so between, so next year is the big one. What have you done in between? Go on.
It's this year.
Oh,
yeah.
I thought it was 2020.
So I bought this domain name, South Pole 2020.
Yeah.
Because in all likelihood, I'll finish in very early 2020. And it confuses everybody because they go, oh, you're leaving next year. And actually, because the travelling season for Antarctica is over our Christmas and New Year, I'm leaving in, I don't know, 250 days or something like that this year. And then we'll arrive back in the UK in 2020.
What have you done then in regards to previous expeditions?
So I decided that the end goal was to get to Antarctica. And then I kind of worked backwards and to work out what it was that I needed to do in order to achieve that. And they don't just let people go to Antarctica. They want you to have a sort of polar CV, if you like. So they want to see that you've done some training in Norway or, you know, and in May last year, I skied across Greenland. So two of my teammates were from the original expedition that kind of drew me in the first place. And another one was ex-army, and then there was a girl, and then my now dear friend Pete, who runs a tattoo parlour and is completely kind of real wild card in every sense. And we had this amazing, epic trip across Greenland, which was an adventure in every, you know, if you can imagine a polar journey and all the things that happened. You know, we had a hurricane, you know, one of the tents disappeared, and, you know, lots of things happened. But we succeeded and we got to the other side, and that was a big, for me, I found that I had reserves of resilience that I didn't know that were there.
How many is in the team?
Six in the team.
And how far is it across?
It's 570 kilometres.
Ah, yeah. And then that's unsupported.
Yeah.
Just the six of you as the team. And what is the terrain like? Because you hear Greenland. I think it's anything but green, isn't it?
So I think that was a marketing, fake news, marketing ploy from Eric the Red in the 6th century, who was trying to get people to move there, said it was called Greenland. And actually, it's a beautiful but completely desolate place. There's people living on the sort of rocky edges of the country, eking out an existence like they have done for, you know, centuries. And they rely very much on hunting. And a lot of the time, those settlements are frozen in. They can't, you know, people can't get supplies in and out. It's quite an unusual place, given that it's technically part of Denmark. It's in the, you know, the Western world, and it has a real otherworldly feel. And people talk about it as being Antarctica's little sister, because it's the only permanent ice sheet outside of Antarctica. And in between these little settlements on the edges is this vast ice sheet with just nothing, just nothingness for us, you know. And after sort of 2 or 3 days getting up through the edges of the glacier and up onto the ice sheet, you have 360 degree white horizon for almost a month.
Right. And what physically then, how are we, let's not go to training on this one, actually. Let's go physically during the actual kind of expedition. What are you putting your body through? What mum of four, you know, in your 30s doing this, what are you putting yourself through?
I'm 41 now.
41 now? 41. Was you in your late?
Yeah, no, this was only last year.
Oh, was it? God, bad prep for me, this.
I'd done a lot of training for Greenland. And so you take a special sledge called a polk, and that polk is your own polk, and you have food, you have some fuel, you have some team kit, so a tent. We took a rifle in case we saw any polar bears, so we all shared out the sort of team kit amongst us. And that probably weighed, I always think it's never a good idea to weigh your polk because that just weighs on your mind, but it probably weighed about 40, 50 kilos, so not ridiculous. Yeah. And then you ski with that attached to you for 10, 11, 12 hours a day. And then at the end of that skiing day, you then put your tent up, dive in, and then you start your cooking and melting snow, and that takes quite a long time. And then you get your head down, and then you get up the next day and do it all again. And there's very little time. In fact, I can remember sitting on my polk for about 5 minutes with nothing to do, and that was the only time when I didn't have anything to do the whole time that I was out there. So it's not unlike having a, you know, the responsibility of a small family, but you get to sleep at night as well. So, you know, any time I was having a bad day, and I didn't, you know, it's quite weird that you, when you're on a long range journey, it's not like you feel worse and worse and worse as you get more and more tired. You sort of have some good days and then you have a couple of bad days, and there doesn't seem to be necessarily any rhyme or reason to it. But, you know, if I was having a particularly bad day, then I'd be thinking, well, at least I get to sleep at night. At least I've only got myself to look after.
Mm.
And, you know, really drew on those kind of times when I was managing all those things.
Mm. You're missing the kids as well at this point?
More than I thought I would.
Yeah.
But I remember calling them, and we had sat phones, so I called them maybe twice when I was out there, because it didn't help me actually to call them. I figured out it, you know, I wanted to kind of focus on what I was doing and try not to miss them. But I rang the kids and I said, "Oh, it's Mama. I'm phoning from Greenland on the sat phone. How are you all?" And the first one that came on, I can't remember which child, went, "Oh, such and such has borrowed my whatever it is, and where's my blah blah blah." And I was trying to kind of manage the household from Greenland, and it was reassuring to know that, you know, everything was fine and life was going on just as it always did. But that was kind of hilarious.
Is that parenting? Is that down to parenting?
In
terms of their resilience to be able to cope when you're not there?
That's an interesting question. They're very good at managing upwards. So especially the youngest is 10, but the middle two in particular have spent a lot of time knowing kind of either dad's at home or mum's at home, but, you know, mum's off and away doing either a marathon run or, you know, going off to do something. And they'll say, okay, so, and we'll all sit down and have a sort of family power on a Sunday night and say, right, what have we got going on this week? Who needs to be where? And they're really good at saying, right, it's Tuesday is this, and I'm doing it this time, and this is how I'm going to get home. And so they are pretty independent. Resilience, I don't know, because you always need your mum and dad, I think, but teenagers kind of suck the emotion or life out of you. I don't know if you've got this to come, but they're, you know, that bigger children mean bigger problems sometimes. And they have, you know, they've had to navigate that kind of growing up and dealing with all those things, but they're pretty amazing kids, and they will come to me and say, "I need you to spend some time with me because of this," or if I'm going out to do some training, I try and encourage one of them to come and spend some time and just have a chat as you're walking along. But I suppose they are resilient, come to think of it. Yeah.
Sounds it. How old are they?
Almost 20, 16, 14 and 10.
All right, a big range. What is what's training like now? We're going to the South Pole. What do we have to do daily, weekly?
So the expedition itself is a solo, unsupported, unassisted attempt to be the fastest woman to ski to the South Pole. And it gets a bit technical, because in polar circles, these monikers, these titles, these categories do seem to matter. But what it is essentially is me and my polk with all my stuff in it, and no outside assistance means you can't use kites or vehicles. And I can't, if I want to keep to that category, I can't accept any fuel or food drops or anything like that. But help is available if it was required, you know, in an emergency. But the polk would be much heavier, so the main weight is things like food and fuel, and it'll be heavier than I am. It'll probably be about 80 kilos, something like that. Mm. And to do that over a sustained period is, you know, it's a bit like marathon training, in that you probably never do the full marathon until the day of the marathon. So I won't go out and pull an 80 kilogram weight for 38 days in order to train for it, but I'm training twice a day, 6 days a week, roughly, at the moment. And I have this amazing endurance coach called John from E3 Endurance. So I've got to give him a shout out, because he's doing this, you know, to support the expedition. And it's all done by an app. I've only ever met him once. So you get this app and you get sent these things to do, and all you have to do is do it. So it's actually surprisingly, if you think about training, and certainly kind of the army approach to it, it's like, go for it, go as much hard as you can for as long as you can, and, you know, really thrash yourself. And actually the training's been a lot more lot more slow build, and so it's all about leg strength, endurance, and core strength. And so a lot, most of it is not, you know, cardio, lung busting, that kind of thing. Most of it is really manageable. So there are some sessions like hill reps and stuff, which I dread every single week. But I never feel a lack of motivation to do it, because I know that if I do every session, I'll have done everything I can from a physical point of view, because I'm only 5'5", I'm not particularly tall. So I need to kind of do everything I can to optimise my experience there. And it's going to be hard enough. So you want to make sure you're at the physical, in physically good shape, so you can kind of put your energies into the mental game.
What would a session, I don't know, tomorrow morning, what would you be doing? What's the kind of standard, I don't know, 3 or 4 different sessions you'd be doing?
So I've got this tyre, because you can't train with a Polk in the UK because there's no snow. So I've got this big 4x4 tyre called Snoopy. And Snoopy's all branded up with my charity logos, and he goes a lot of places with me. So some of it will be dragging that for an hour and a half, and you drag it behind you and you drag it walking backwards, and it's all to mimic the kind of things you'll be doing when you're on the expedition. Or hill reps, so, you know, 25 odd reps of running up and down a hill, or very long trips walking with your tyre. So you end up going pretty slowly, but, you know, out for 2.5 hours. And then running with weight, so a lot of park run, and I actually honestly dread park run usually, because it always feels like race day. But when you've got some weight on, you've got a bit of an excuse, so you can kind of just plod around and do your own thing, and that's great to kind of, you get it done for the day, and then you're free. But most of the sessions are more time consuming than that, and then in the evenings, a stretching session, a core session, so sort of squats and plank and sit-ups and that kind of thing. And I've got to do it wherever I possibly can. So one of mine went off to do a class, and I took my mat, rolled it out outside the class on the floor, and did my session there because I had an hour to do it. And you can't waste any opportunity. You can't kind of put it off and think I'll do it later, because then that day's gone. And, you know, that's a training session that you've missed. And my inner voice then says to me, that's it, you know, you'll never do another session again.
It sounds very much like you know, you're focusing on those tiny little things that would probably cause an injury, the kind of tiny microfibers within your body and your core and your hamstrings and all those little things. But Charlie Martel, who I'm good friends with, he is rowing the Pacific. And I always keep saying, oh, when are you, how much rowing are you doing? How much are you on the Concept 2? And he's like, no, I'm not doing any of that. Like, I'm going to row myself fit when I go across it. I don't need to row until I start rowing. It's such a long process for him, and it will be for you. It's a long, long process. Has that kind of support then been crucial in getting to where you are now, from external people like your coach and partners, kind of sponsors and whatnot? Is that really fundamental in getting to the pole?
I think it's, even though this is a solo journey, is definitely not a one woman show by any stretch of the imagination. That you've got to draw on so many people's support, and, you know, you need your kind of, there's a lot of people who've got a lot of opinions about should you or shouldn't you be going, you know, how you should approach it, what the key is, you know, and actually you need, there's a lot of noise, and what you need is a sort of trusted circle of people who you can listen to, and you, because somebody will say one thing and somebody will say the complete opposite, and you're just thinking, you know, at the end of the day, you've got to have a sort of group that is your sounding board, that kind of, they've got experience or they know you. That's been a sort of good ploy for me to try and kind of see through all the other distractions. But people's belief in me has been quite astounding, even when I don't always believe in myself. And so, you know, people say, you're definitely going to do this. And there are some days when the idea of challenge is that it's scary and you don't know whether you're going to complete it. If I knew, you know, if the challenge was to walk to the end of the street, that's not very much of a challenge because you know you can achieve it. It's when it's sort of almost one step beyond what you think you can do. And you know it's going to challenge you in every sense. But everyone said, oh, you know, everyone always says, I know you can do this. And that's that belief in me, especially when from some sponsors and other kind of partners, when I was literally just starting out and it was more of an idea than anything else. And they said, yeah, we're on board with this. We think this is great. And that's meant that this, the expedition almost has a life and momentum of its own now. It's more than just something in my head. It's real and it's, you know, it's progressing and I'm bringing sponsors on board. And although I'm not fully funded yet, I believe it's going to happen. And I think that's kind of that's where the kind of tipping point came, probably about October, November last year, where it went from something that, oh, it's, you know, it's ages away and it's kind of all quite conceptual. I'm not really sure whether this is going to happen, to right, this is absolutely happening. And since then, everything's kind of accelerated. And, you know, that's why we're doing podcasts and talking to big sponsors and going to schools. And one of the big important things for me for this whole journey is about, and it is, again, it's a journey. It's not just about what's going to happen between the start point and the pole. It's about what's happened to from the start of the idea to the very end of the journey. It's about how that inspires other people to look at long-term goals and challenges, because everybody always has to say, you know, we've all got busy lives, lots of people have responsibilities, and it's always the same things. It's, I won't get the time off work, I can't afford it, or who's going to look after the kids, the parents, the dog, the house, whatever it
excuses.
Is.
Excuses.
You could put it like that. I mean, it's a bit of a mental leap to get from these are challenges to be overcome. And that's a Shackleton quote, you know, challenges are just things to be overcome after all. And instead of seeing them as barriers, look at them as challenges to be overcome. So you think you're not going to get time off work, have you asked? And actually, are you in a position where you can take 6 weeks off and look for something else? You know, maybe it's an opportunity to look at, and that's not available to everybody, but you know, actually employers can be quite on board with the idea of, because expeditions can teach you so much about things like teamwork, about goal setting, about commitment, about determination, about equanimity. So, you know, you've got to get up and ski, but the weather's terrible, but you could kind of just shrug your shoulders and get on with it. And all those things can be really good things to bring back to an employer. And, you know, the thing about the money, I'm not independently wealthy by any means. You know, I'm an army spouse. We haven't got any money. But our sponsors, you know, get yourself out there and get those opportunities, create those opportunities, grab those opportunities and just see what comes along. And, you know, it's 5 years of, by the time I stand at the South Pole, of planning and sacrifice and training and determination to make this happen. So it's not an easy thing, but it is an achievable thing, because I'm really ordinary. I'm not particularly, you know, I've just been taken on, but I'm not sure I'm allowed to announce the name yet, but by a brand as in their pro athlete program, which is laughable at, you know, 41. I'm not a pro athlete, or I wasn't until, you know, last week. And the interesting thing is that life is in series. It's not, I'm going to do X when I grow up, and if you don't end up doing that, then life's a disaster. It's about making that great opportunity and then moving away to, you know, maybe that will take you in another direction. So, you know, you don't, just because you haven't achieved greatness by 18, it doesn't mean that, you know, you can't sort of choose to do something else. And and it's also about not necessarily having it all, because, you know, I had quite a different career before I took a couple of steps down from my career-wise to focus on adventures. So, you know, you perhaps can't have a glittering career, a perfect family, and our family is, you know, we haven't definitely, you know, you never get it right as a parent, do you? You know, and you don't have all the answers. But, you know, maybe you can have an amazing kind of adventure or something outside of work and not be focused on your career for a little while, but then go back to it. So, you know, it's just not having it all at once.
I think there's a lot of, not to be taken out of that, with regards to kind of goal setting, deconstructing the end goal as well. And you know, we spoke to people like Si Harmer and Dave Henson, who have both lost legs, and it was all about them was just the small gains. So no matter what it is, you know, and we said like the end of the street for somebody is a massive expedition to get to the end of the street. For you, it's bigger, but understanding and breaking it down is key in that, and also having people around you that support you and creating that environment where a growth environment where people are willing you on. Do you feel like you're a good role model to your children?
Oh, that's a difficult question. You know,
because you are taking risk. Some people may say that's a risk, a reckless risk, because you're going into somewhere like Antarctica. But I'm interested to hear what you've got to say.
I think it's really interesting to unpick some of that, because I wonder, well, first of all, I wonder if a man would be asked that question, potentially yes, but that's the first sort of thing that jumps into my head. And whenever I ask people, you know, did you know how many children Shackleton had or how many years he spent in Antarctica? Nobody knows the answer. But, you know, life is full of risk, and driving home is probably the most dangerous thing we'll all do today. Mm. But you've got to also embrace living life to the full and whatever that means for you. And what I want to show my children is that if you're passionate about something, you can make amazing things happen. If you don't let anybody tell you that what you want to do is not a valid thing to do, and don't let anybody tell you that, you know, oh, it's too difficult to get into, whether that be, you know, one of them wants to be a film director, one of them wants to be an archaeologist. If you want to do something, you can make it happen, pretty much.
Mm, brilliant. What else? What's the future? What's this next couple of months? What's anything you want to talk about?
I'm still gathering, whatever
you want to do.
So, I'm raising money for ABF, the Soldiers Charity, and for the Youth Adventure Trust, two amazing charities, and I want to raise at least as much money for them as it's going to cost to run the expedition. And going to Antarctica is expensive because you're looking at flying in and out, you're looking at medical cover, you're looking at all the logistics support that goes with that. And it's an expensive operation, you know. It's not something you could sort of find a fiver down the back of the sofa and go off. And there are much more cost-effective ways of going on at big adventures. But to get to the South Pole, it's a lot of money. And so I'm still looking for sponsors, I'm still looking for financial backing, and then later on when I'm fully funded, for money for these two amazing charities. So the next few months will be certainly training and looking for sponsors, and also pursuing that aim of inspiring others through giving talks or writing things for the media. Mm. And trying to get all those things, the charity and the funding and the fitness and everything in place at home and the kit and everything, all over the line at the same time, to get off to the start point with everything kind of in place. And I'm sure that's not going to happen. It's going to be chaos, and I won't get the last of the money till I get on the plane. And but definitely kind of complete laser focus on getting the expedition to the start point. And that's not to say that when I'm at work, by the way, because I have a full-time job as well, that I'm not fully focused on that, because I think that's it's almost quite easy to be like, right now I'm training, totally focused on that. Now I'm at home, I'm baking and I'm picking up from school and doing all those things, and I'm at work and I'm totally focused on that. So, but it is, I don't have a social life, I don't go out, and so it's about choosing how you spend your time, because it's precious. And so, you know, spending it sort of sat on the sofa thinking I'll do it next week is just not something that's ever, you know, been part of who I am. So, you know, you've got to do something towards your goal every single day, every day, even if it's something small, and even if it's an email, and even if it's writing to a journalist, if it's writing to a sponsor or arranging a talk, or, you know, tinkering with some kit. You've got to do something, and that's in addition to the training, something every day to get you towards that long-term goal. Otherwise it hasn't been a useful day.
What's your website?
South Pole 2020.
And how do we find you on social media?
And I'm on Instagram under @BetweenSnowAndSky.
Twitter.
So Twitter stupidly doesn't allow you enough characters, so I'm between snow, sky, without any without anything.
I'll be retweeting everything and whatnot. And thanks so much for coming in, Wendy. And we will leave it there.